Robert Fisk, we're very eager to get an independent view of this showdown between the BBC and Tony Blair on sexed up intelligence, on Armageddon weapons, or sexed up news reporting. What does it look like to you?
Well, from where I am, which is Beirut, which is in the Middle East, which isn't that far from Baghdad, it looks like a distraction. You know, I remember when the first so-called dossier, how the British love the word dossier, came out last September. I thought to myself when I read it, this is a very, very odd document. It was supposedly 50 pages, but only 15 of those pages dealt with weapons of mass destruction. And even then, they were dotted with words like may have, could have, would have. The rest of the pages were about Saddam Hussein's history, the history of Iraq, the history of the British intelligence services, and indeed the history, which is verifiable and correct, of Saddam's human rights abuses. Even in this element, this so-called September dossier, which Blair continues to pathetically defend, was mendacious. For example, in one extract it says that in the city of Basra in the spring of 1991, Shiite Muslims of Iraq staged riots, I use the word riots, that's what they called them, against the Saddam regime, and were ruthlessly repressed with many thousands of dead. Now, the repressions and the dead are correct. What the British left out was, these weren't riots. This was a rebellion encouraged by President George Bush Sr. and by the British government. But they deleted that. Even, they couldn't even be accurate and historically honest about events that had occurred more than 10 years before. So how could we trust them on the weapons of mass destruction? This was the big issue when the dossier came out.
And then there was the second dossier, after Downing Street had, by all accounts, appealed for a tougher
line. Yes, and the second one contained the famous 45 minutes.
Yes.
Now, what we have learned from the inquiry in London, and again, I think this is a distraction from the real tragedy which is happening in Iraq, for Iraqis, for Americans, for all foreigners there, and for the UN. What we have learned in the case of the second so-called, quote, dossier, unquote, is that the weapons which might have been deployed in 45 minutes, the chemical and biological weapons, did not indicate weapons which could be fired at Cyprus, the nearest British base, or indeed London. They indicated mortar shells which might be fired in conventional combat. In other words, the British people were told, and the British Parliament went to war on the basis of the idea that Saddam Hussein could fire a missile at Trafalgar Square. That's what most of the newspapers in Britain said, not my own, thank God, which led people to say, okay, we have to go to war. Now it turns out, when John Scarlett, one of the most secretive and spooky of the people in the British government who are involved in intelligence, gives evidence, this referred to mortar shells, which can't be fired more than, I think, about 2 miles.
What do you make of David Kelly's role here, not knowing him, but knowing the field?
David Kelly was a very experienced UN arms inspector. And the Iraqis I've met who were involved in those inspections remember him. They remember David Kelly standing outside the agriculture ministry in the center of Baghdad, not far from the Palestine Hotel, saying, we will not leave here until we can get into the agriculture ministry to check the biological, potential biological weapons document inside. He was a tough guy. He was in at the middle. He frightened the Iraqis. He'd done dozens of visits to Iraq. He was not a Walter Mitty, as Blair's own pathetic spokesman, Tom Kelly, claimed. He was a man with a deep and serious knowledge of what the Iraqis were doing, to the point where he got to know the Iraqi weapons inspectors themselves quite well. He got to know the people who were making the weapons. This was a very important, crucial man in the intelligence apparatus of the British government. And when Tony Blair's spokesman, Tom Kelly, no relation, thank God, to David Kelly, said he was a Walter Mitty character. I thought to myself, Tony Blair must be on the run. One thing you need to understand, Tom Kelly is from Northern Ireland, and he grew up in Northern Ireland. He was in the Northern Ireland office, you know, the sort of occupation authority of Belfast, if you like, although it's not that bad now. And when he was there, I was in Northern Ireland, and every time the British Army had to cover up or make excuses for the death of someone who was obviously innocent, the British Army would describe those people who had just died and been killed as Walter Mitty characters.
Really?
And it's very interesting that Tom Kelly used this same phrase, Walter Mitty. He has no more knowledge of James Thurber's novels than the British Army did. When he wanted to talk to my colleague on The Independent a few days ago, I think he got this obscene phrase from the British Army in Northern Ireland. And I think he just regurgitated it. I don't think he has any, as I say, any more knowledge about Thurber than, you know, fantasies or anyone else than the British Army does. But I think that's where it came from. And Kelly, Tom Kelly, again, not Dr. David Kelly, who committed suicide, allegedly. Tom Kelly comes from Northern Ireland.
Let's linger on that 1 minute. Unmistakably, Tony Blair's government and Tony Blair wanted to push David Kelly into the open. They did trivialize him with this Walter Mitty line. Can you imagine the pressure that David Kelly felt he was under before he died?
Chris, I've got to say to you, I can imagine, but I'm, you know, 4,000 kilometers away. I'm not covering the Tribunal in London. I'm actually on the ground in the Middle East. I know there were many weapons inspectors like David Kelly who felt during the UN regime when, remember, Tony Blair didn't have the patience, nor did George Bush, to wait for the inspector's, you know, final investigation. I know that at that time, many of the inspectors felt that they were under great pressure from the United States, from Britain, to produce results which they didn't believe to be true. And to be fair to them, they did not produce fraudulent results. They kept the line. Now, I'm sure that David Kelly was the same. But if you're going to ask me the pressures he felt under living in his mock Tudor house in, you know, north of London, I just have no idea. I'm the wrong person to ask.
Well, clearly he told several people, not just Andrew Gilligan, but others at the BBC, and I'm sure other reporters, that there was something fishy here. He was then forced to testify. The BBC named him too.
Well, the BBC named him after his death, didn't they?
Yes.
After which he couldn't testify.
But what does it tell you that the British government wanted him on the record in public by name?
Well, if you read the vast amount of evidence which has come out of the Hutton Tribunal, yes, and I'm sure you've read more of it than I have out here in the Middle East, and I've read a lot of it in not in English, but in Arabic or in French, it's quite clear that there was an attempt by the British Ministry of Defence to say, this is the guy, we should release his name. We'll let the journalists choose to name him, and if they get him right, we'll say yes. And the normal rules governing the British Civil Service is that you don't do that. So someone, either Jeff Hoon, the defense minister, who's known as a very mendacious character, or Blair himself, said, let's say it was Kelly. If you actually rewatch the videotapes, as I have, of the questioning of Kelly by the Parliamentary Committee, a committee which was instructed by the Minister of Defence, Hoon, not to ask him whether he believed the documents and the details of the British document were correct, the so-called dossier, it's obvious they were baiting him. They were cruel, very cruel to him. The way they spoke to him, the manner in which they addressed him, must have been extremely provocative and extremely hurtful to a man who has spent so much of his time as a weapons inspector in Iraq and as a senior civil servant to be called before he was dead, a person who was just, well, I think one of the MPs called him just a punchball between the Ministry of Defence and the BBC, and after death of Walter Mitty, tells you about the collapse of morality and governance in Britain. But let me repeat again, I think that the whole Hutton inquiry is becoming a distraction from the collapse of American power in Iraq, which is the big story we should be looking at.
We'll come back to it one sec. The Murdoch press in London and Murdoch television in the States, too, makes much of a so-called BBC vendetta against Tony Blair. What do you make of that? How should we hear that?
Well, I'm a correspondent who once worked for the Times newspaper of London, and after it was taken over by Murdoch, after some 3 or 4 years, many of the staff became frightened of Murdoch, and I started getting messages here in Beirut asking me to re-justify stories I'd written long before. Hmm. If you accept the kind of Murdoch journalism, that's what you get. I left the Times and went to The Independent, which is now my newspaper, The Independent, which you can read on www.independent.co.uk.
Read it all the time.
And me too. Well, good. But the point is that, there's no doubt that the Murdoch group is against the BBC. It's against any kind of free journalism. Let me just add, the BBC has a lot to answer for. It is not a clean, perfect organization. It's very effete. It allows the most pathetic people to take over as director general, like John Burt, who became a lapdog of Tony Blair. He works for Blair now as a sort of paid consultant on everything from motorways to communication. The BBC is top heavy with very odd people, but at least it maintains the impartiality with which it was founded, back in the 1920s. Murdoch's attack on it is entirely predictable. Murdoch's press, in the French have a wonderful word for a person like Murdoch. They call him a papivore, a person who eats newspapers. Mm. And by using the vast resources of his media group, he can undercut other newspapers, starve them. He can cut price his own newspapers to destroy them. Mm. I mean, the Times newspaper of London, after I left it, went to The Independent, was cut by 50% in price, using money from more profitable areas of the Murdoch empire, and the Times was not profitable at that time, in order to try to kill The Independent, my own newspaper. It didn't work, but some readers did go to the Times because it was cheaper. It was an attempt to use money to stifle free speech. Now, you ask me what I think of Murdoch and the BBC. It's the same thing.
Well, I really wonder about the BBC and Tony Blair. Has the BBC told it reasonably straight here, do you think?
Look, Chris, I don't work for the BBC, and I may be the wrong person to ask. I had criticisms of them during the Iraq War because I thought that they bent too much towards the authorities. For example, they always referred to the coalition forces attacking Iraq, yes, without referring to the fact they didn't have a UN permission to do so, and without referring to the fact that at that stage the coalition forces were the Americans, the British, and about 400 Australians. The moment the Americans occupied Baghdad, the BBC started referring to the Anglo-American invasion, which is what they should have called it from the start. So the BBC is not as brave as it would like to think it is, but it's probably a lot braver than Mr. Campbell and Mr. Blair would like it to be. Mm. During the war, I remember Raghi Omar, who is a good friend and colleague of mine, so I declare that interest, reporting out of Baghdad under fire, of course, from his own British and American allies, if you use that word, and doing so with great guts and courage and telling the truth about the civilian casualties. And that is what people came over the decades to rely on from the BBC, even during the Second World War. Something that Mr. Blair didn't want, Mr. Hoon didn't want. When I reported on the civilian casualties, Mr. Hoon effectively said I was a liar, which I'm happy about because I think he's the minister of mendacity, but there we go. Mm. But the BBC did try to stand its ground. It had some excellent correspondents in Baghdad, and they fought their ground and they got the truth out. So, it's a big book.
It's a pretty good score, though.
It's probably a three-volume book.
Yeah. Robert Fisk, tell us about the tragedy behind all this hoo-ha.
Well, the real tragedy is that an American president and our own dear Prime Minister, Mr. Blair, surrounded by, in my view, sinister right-wing neoconservative advisers, the worst side of the Republican Party, indeed the worst side of Americanism, because I think America is a wonderful country, but this, these people do not represent it. I don't even know if Mr. Bush was actually really elected president. These people have been pushing a version of the Iraq War originally to the Israelis. These people, I'm talking about you know, the Pearls and the Wolfowitzes and the Frees and others, they were pushing for the Likud party in Israel and for Netanyahu, and they wanted to take over the party, an idea that the Iraqi regime had to be deposed. And they sold this idea to Bush after September 11th, 2001, an event that has nothing at all to do with Iraq. Iraq did not carry out the attacks of September 11th. Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I mean, there may be people in Saddam's regime who would have liked to, but they didn't, full stop. And the American government deliberately set out with extraordinarily illiberal legislation, which you know more about than I do,
yes.
Although I have the wonderful random security check on every flight I take in the United States, set out to terrify the people of America. The day that changed the world, September 11th, 2001, did not change the world. 17,500 Lebanese, most of them civilians, died in the Israeli invasion, sanctioned by the United States, of 1982. No one lit candles. No one said it changed the world. In September 16th to 18th of that same year, 1982, 1,700 Palestinians were murdered, massacred here in Beirut, very close, what, 3 miles from where I'm speaking to you from. And that's more than half the total dead of the World Trade Center. Nobody lit candles. Nobody said it changed the world. What's happened is that a very right-wing caucus of Americans, a group of American political leaders surrounded by some very sinister advisors, have set out on a path to change the map of the Middle East. Partly because it's a right-wing agenda, partly because it's a conservative agenda, partly, given their background, because it's also an Israeli agenda, although many brave Israelis say that they don't want this agenda, they think it will make their world less safe, and I think they may be right, people like Uri Avnery, for example, or Amir Ahaz. And they have plunged into Iraq, saying, we're going to liberate it. We're going to destroy, find the weapons of mass destruction. There aren't any. We're going to create democracy. I don't think they can. And President Bush has now put, with the support of these advisors, 146,000, I think now actually 152,000 American troops in the biggest rat's nest. That's not a racist comment. I'm talking in political terms. Mm-hmm. Is the Middle East. They are now being attacked daily, 1, 2, 3 dead a day, by people they claim they were coming to liberate. It is a disaster, and it is going to get worse, and it is going to get more spectacular in the most awful and dreadful sense of the word. And this tragedy, in which another British soldier died in the last few hours, one of my countrymen, this tragedy is being obscured by the beginnings of the presidential election campaign in the United States, by the Hutton Tribunal in London, and indeed by an Australian parliamentary tribunal on the same question of did the Australian government sex up the evidence. The American government lied about the evidence about Iraq. The British government lied and the Australian government lied, and we went to war based on lies. This does not mean that Saddam was a nice guy. He was a vicious guy. He did kill and gas hundreds of thousands of people. Most of those people were gassed when we, Britain and America, were Saddam's friends. And indeed, I remember that I was on a train coming back from the Iran-Iraq war front in 1983 with Iranian soldiers coughing up gas from their lungs so badly that I was going around opening the windows of the train. At the very moment when the Americans under Ronald Reagan at that time, of course, as president, had sent a special delegate to see Saddam Hussein in Baghdad to reopen the embassy. And that delegate, as we all know, was Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, you know, you say this is being obscured by the presidential campaign. I'd also say it's feeding back into the presidential campaign. This is a very sober Labor Day weekend for Americans, and I think a time of shifting opinion and deepening curiosity. So this is a very important story that you're telling, Robert Fisk.
Well, it's nice of you to say so. I travel to the States on average every 3.5 weeks to give lectures, and I'm due to go to Ireland and then on to back to Beirut in the next few days and then on to Baghdad again. I get so exhausted, frankly. I wake up on aeroplanes, sometimes across the Atlantic, wondering which direction I'm traveling in. But one of the most interesting things for me, you know, is to go to the States so frequently and to see American public opinion, to see how rarely it seems to accord with the administration. You know, I talk to people on planes flying out of Dallas-Fort Worth to Kansas City or on my way to L.A. or San Francisco, and I deliberately try to talk to the people next to me on the plane. I talk to the crew, and they don't believe what their government tells them on the Middle East. Well, and the moment you say, well, I can speak freely about it, they speak freely too. It's amazing.
Well, I think we're learning. We're learning to speak our own sense on this thing, and it is not the government line. May I just say, I always think of you as the man, as you've described yourself, who has been spent a lifetime covering wars along those borders that your father's generation drew after World War I. Northern Ireland, the Balkans, and the Middle East. Is there any way out in our lifetimes? And is this, as I sense, the worst?
Well, listen, I tell you something. I'm writing a book over Christmas and the spring, which hopefully will be published in the summer, late summer, which is called The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. The Great War for Civilization is the title where it's engraved on the back of my father's, my late father's, First World War campaign medal. And the book is about the malign influence of history and whether we can escape from it. The title, The Conquest of the Middle East, may turn to Retreat from the Middle East, depending on what happens in Iraq. But I don't know if we can escape from it. I really don't know. Malcolm MacDonald was British colonial secretary in the 30s, and he did one of the white papers on Jewish immigration to Palestine. He was trying to restrict Jewish immigration, which, given Nazi Germany's existence at that time, could have been seen and was seen by Jews, of course, as a very, very cruel act. And I don't think MacDonald ever got over it, and nor probably should he have done. But I remember not long before his death, when I was interviewing him for my PhD thesis at an Irish university, as a matter of fact, about Ireland in the Second World War, which was neutral, he looked up at me and pointed his finger at me, and he said, "But you're in the Middle East because I failed." And I've always remembered that. Almost every week, every month, I remember that, you know, I'm a correspondent out here because of Lord Balfour's declaration, because of the fraudulent promises of Lawrence of Arabia to the Arabs, because of the failure of British colonial rule in Palestine, because of the failure of French colonial rule in Syria and Lebanon, and the creation of the artificial state of Lebanon, because of British colonial rule in Jordan, British colonial rule in Iraq, that it all goes back to history, and we cannot shake it free. That, in its lightest terms, I suspect accounts for our fascination with, say, the Titanic, or Pearl Harbor even. But in its darkest terms, it means that we constantly repeat the mistakes of our fathers or our grandfathers. I have in my home a document put on the walls in Baghdad by Lieutenant General Sir Stanley Maude, who had invaded Iraq for the British in 1917. And it begins with the words, I quote to you, "To the people of the Vilaya of Baghdad," the Vilaya meant the city, the regional governorate, "to the people of Baghdad, we come here not as conquerors but as liberators to free you from generations of tyranny." And that is exactly what the Americans now say to the Iraqis. And after 1917, let me add, a ferocious guerrilla war began against the British, and the hundreds of British military victims lie to this day in the North Wall Cemetery in Baghdad. Isn't history repeating itself?
Robert Fisk, it's a privilege to hear you. I wish we heard you more. You bring that freight of history to everything you write, and you inspire us.
Don't be so kind. I've just been to the dentist, so my half my face is in the rictus of having injections to cure the pain of my filling. So it's a bad time to talk to me about such things, but it's nice to talk to you.
My great pleasure. Thank you, Robert Fisk.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.